in a relationship, like a marriage or some kind of important partnership, the relationship can be severely tested when one member of the partnership becomes severely ill or something like that. Sometimes the relationship cannot hold and it dissolves, but sometimes it gets stronger. So relationship bonds can be strengthened by suffering. We see this in wartime, in combat, where the bonds between soldiers can become extremely strong, or in between victims of natural disasters and so on. In a relationship, sometimes the problem is not caused by the healthy partner withdrawing or something like that. Sometimes the suffering person, him or herself, withdraws and can't stand feeling pitied or something like that, and won't allow anyone to get close to them. So whether the relationship will hold or not, I think, depends on the basis of the relationship. If it's been based on narcissistic needs for things like status or power or wealth or something like that, then it may fall apart. It may not hold if those things fall away. If the relationship was based on authentic love, then the bond of intimacy between the people might become even deeper, and then care for the suffering partner can become a spiritual practice in its own right, a devotional practice. Now, suffering demands courage sometimes, because sometimes you may have to make a conscious decision between giving up and going on living. Sometimes in the middle of severe crises or illness, people consciously think, do I want to go on with this, or shall I just give up? There is sometimes a call to death. The question of suicide or just allowing oneself to slip away often arises. So sometimes one has to consciously decide to keep going or not. Another important point is that suffering can be a major stimulus to the imagination. A great deal of creative work comes out of suffering. Without the challenge of some kind of suffering, some people would never strive at all, would never be creative. And many great works of art and music and so on take a long time to produce and involve a good deal of suffering. It's also been suggested that during our evolution as a species, that suffering was one of the factors that stimulated our ability to think and stimulated brain development, because we had to develop our thinking ability just to be able to deal with problems that arise. And certainly many people think that suffering is one of the main sources of the development of religion, because all religions offer some kind of approach to suffering and some attitude to it, and they offer spiritual explanations for suffering. And that's why Jung said that religions are what he called psychotherapeutic systems, meaning that they help you deal with problems of living. It's important to understand that all these explanations imply a particular God image. You can have a God image where you think of the divine as a stern but loving father. You could have a simplistic reward punishment psychology. Suffering is a punishment for sin, that kind of thing. But as Job discovered, apparently meaningless suffering can require a radical change in your God image, what Jung referred to as the transformation of God. Job said, I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now I see you, when he had the whirlwind vision of God in the whirlwind. So he had a traditional notion of God, and then he went through his period of intense suffering, and he realized that the tradition, and his friends, so-called Job's comforters, tried to insist on a traditional image of God, that suffering is a punishment for sin. And Job was able to say, no, I haven't done anything so terrible that I deserve what's happened to me. So that produced a radical change in his God image, and that's what Jung's answer to Job is all about. Jung thought that the book of Job forced a change in the canonical God image from the image of God in the Hebrew Bible to the incarnation in Christ. So Jung thought that you had to have a change in the God image from a kind of angry war god, Yahweh kind of Hebrew Bible image, into the notion of a God of love who's incarnate, who becomes human. And Jung thought that the incarnation in Christ was the answer to Job, this radical transformation of the God image. I think it's in one of the letter to Eleanor Kochnik where Jung talks about the transformation of God. I can't remember which letter it's in, but it might be to her. Jung writes that as we go more and more into the unconscious, we will transform our God image. And I thought I might give you a quick example of that, because I think it's a rather important idea, because many of us think that our God image is changing again now. There is an idea out there now that the Christian era is slowly coming to an end. And Edward Edinger, the Los Angeles Jungian, in the mid-80s, wrote that he thought that there was a new dispensation emerging. Here, dispensation means the way in which divine grace is dispensed into the world. And he thought that, so we've had, he thought in the history of the West, we've had the Hebrew dispensation, the law is given on Mount Sinai, carved in stone. Then you have the dispensation in Christ with a radical change of the God image. And now, he thought we have the new idea is that we are directly addressed by the self, by numinous experience, by contact with the transpersonal psyche, through dreams and visionary experiences and so on. And he was of the opinion that this was going to be a new form of spirituality that was emerging based on Jung's psychology. Now, I don't know whether that's a little too grandiose or not, because I think it's too early to tell. But that's currently the theory among some Jungians. Anyway, I'll give you an example of this, as you go into the unconscious, the transformation of the God image may occur. So this is a story of a woman who had a very difficult father problem. Her father was angry and difficult and punitive, very hostile sort of character. And so she starts working in psychotherapy, doing the usual kind of work on this problem. And she has an initial dream in which she's lying in bed and a huge hook, like a fish hook, comes down from the ceiling and hooks her through the chest and lifts her up in the air. So she's helplessly suspended in midair. And then she looks down and she sees a man wearing white robes with white hair and a white beard. And he's pointing a cannon at her. And she realizes that this is God. It's a kind of a Baroque God image, as an old white guy with a big beard. Anyway, so then as she looks down, he starts firing this cannon at her, and she can't get out of the way. She's helpless. So that's a God image that's obviously, that tells you you're going to be punished, you're going to be in trouble, you can't get wood out of the way, there's nothing you can do. That is a direct projection of the father imago that she had onto her God image, you know. And this is a very common issue, that we imagine unconsciously that the way people were treated in our families of origin is somehow projected onto the way we think God is going to treat us. Anyway, after doing the usual kind of work on the father problem, which is at the same time working on her image of God, she has a dream in which she's taken into a large hall. And around the hall, there are images and icons and statues of all the world's religious traditions. And she's told that she can walk around and she can choose any one of them. And the one that she chooses is an image of the laughing Buddha. You've seen images of the laughing Buddha. His name was Hote or Pote. It wasn't Shakyamuni Buddha. It was a 8th or 9th century Japanese Zen monk, I think. But he has a great big belly. He has a huge smile on his face, big ears, and he's carrying a bag with stuff for children in it. But he's joyful. This was an image of joyful spirituality, and that's the direction that she went in. That's what Jung means by the transformation of your God image. And this is one of the major effects of suffering. It's what happens to Job, and it's what happens to many people when they have to rethink their God image when they're suffering. There are still lots of traditionalists around. In the Jewish community, there are still people who believe that the Holocaust was the result of the fact that the people at the time were not sufficiently observant. Now, for many of us, that's a pretty horrifying God image, sort of almost sadistic and cruel, but that's what they believe. They always see suffering as the result of divine intervention, and they often do see suffering as a punishment for deviation from the law. They also see it as a discipline or a test of faith, and so on. The problem of suffering actually permeates the problem of unexplained suffering permeates the Hebrew Bible. The Hebrew Bible does acknowledge that suffering, that the divine may cause suffering. Amos says, "Does evil befall a city lest the Lord wills it?" Isaiah says, "I create suffering and evil." Yeah. The Lamentations, of course, the book of Job and the book of Ruth both have themes in which a pious person suffers for no apparent reason. So it really does repudiate the idea that suffering is a punishment for sin, but that idea persisted nevertheless. And of course, suffering influences theology. So a lot of people think that the problem of suffering influenced the doctrine of the world to come, because the rabbis, as they were developing the tradition, they couldn't accept the idea that God could be unfair. So they came up with the idea that it looks unfair in this world, the distribution of suffering, but don't worry, the books will be balanced in the next world. And there is also a Kabbalistic doctrine of reincarnation, although it's not universally accepted. And Christian theology, of course, has the suffering of Christ as central to it. What seems to trouble Christians who suffer is they often say things to me like this. They say, "How can the God who afflicts me," this is a direct quote from somebody, "how can the God who afflicts me be the same God who promises to save me? How can I reconcile my suffering with what feels like the absence of God? Because I've been told that God is only good, so where is he now when I need him most?" Okay. They come up with a variety of responses to this problem. They teach that God or Christ is present with the sufferer, that God somehow works through or by means of our suffering, or something like this. And in the Gospels, just as in the Jewish tradition, suffering is often seen as a test of faith or a test of endurance or a punishment or a discipline or a trial. But Christ's suffering is an exemplar. And to be a follower of Christ invariably involves suffering. And people often will identify with Christ when they are suffering. There is also a strong sense in the Gospels that suffering is caused by the devil or by evil spirits. Although this embarrasses some rather liberal Christians, the fact that Jesus took possession by demonic spirits seriously. When I ask them about that, they usually shuffle uncomfortably. But as far as I know, there might really be such a thing, and it certainly was an important part of Jesus' ministry. So I wouldn't be so quick to rule it out, but that's another discussion. But the problem is why a good God would cause a world with so much suffering. And of course, the traditions have come up with a wide variety of responses to this. They're called theodicies. That's a $5 word. T-H-E-O-D-I-C-Y.